Welcome to another episode in the series of podcasts 168 Things, where we talk about all things creative and marketing and creative life in general. Hello, everybody. This is another edition of 168 Things, and I've got a fantastic guest with me today, Lou Dixon.
Hello.
Who I referred to in a podcast a couple of weeks ago as being the progenitor of a briefing form that I found very interesting, and I know a lot of other people did too. Actually, what we're going to talk about today is, first of all, copywriting, because Lou has made a living as a copywriter for many, many years. But I wanted to ask you how you first started out as a writer.
As a writer or as a copywriter?
As a writer.
Oh, God, I think I was probably 3 or 4 when I wrote my first book.
What was it about?
I can't remember now. Probably about teddy bears or picnics or horses, actually, at that time. But I used to make books out of any bits of paper that I could find and sort of glue them together and then write in them and do covers and things like that. I was always making books, writing stories. I think even before I could write, I used to make up stories. My mother used to call me the most consummate lying 3-year-old that she'd ever met, because I would just completely make up a story about absolutely anything.
Nice to hear that you got positive feedback so early on.
Yeah, I was just obsessed. I always have been. My dad used to say that kid's got ink in their veins, not blood, because I was always reading or writing, one or the other.
So, I was the same. I used to get my mum to buy me these little notebooks that Sylvine or whatever they were.
Oh, yes, the red and black ones, yeah.
Yeah, fantastic.
I loved them. Yeah,
yes. And then I think we used to get, it's something like sugar used to have stickers in it with pictures in, and I'd put in a picture and then write a story about the pictures.
Yes.
I do remember that vaguely. I'm sure they were great stories.
I'm sure mine was as well. I mean, thankfully, I don't think any of them are in existence any longer. And so I used to keep all these journals, and like you, I loved a good notebook. Nothing made me happier than going to W.H. Smith's for stationery. But still does, actually. There's nothing quite like new stationery. I don't think at that time it had entered my head that it was something I could do as a career. It was just something I did. In fact, I came to that quite late, I think, in terms of thinking about it as a job.
Yeah, I do remember making the connection. I got given a book, not the first book I'd been given, but a book that I really loved when I was about 6, I think. And I remember looking at it and thinking, I want to write one of these. And it wasn't so much like you, it wasn't like this is going to be a job, but that's the thing I want to do. I want to write one of these. That was a book about natural history. So I haven't yet done that.
Oh my God, you're so much more elevated than me. I remember having a similar thought, but it was after I read one of my dad's Dick Francis's.
I think there's more money in that.
I want to write one of these.
So, yeah, well, that's a better commercial proposition, and you'd have had the Queen Mum as one of
your readers. Yeah, one of my avid fans. Yeah, yeah. I'd read my dad's entire set of Dick Francis by the time I was 7.
That's impressive.
Yeah,
he was prolific, wasn't he?
Yeah, there must have been 30 or so of them.
And they're all about horse racing.
All about horse racing. Yeah, I was obsessed, but I did grow up virtually next door to Aintree. And horse racing was a big thing with my dad. He was friends with Ginger McCain, who was Red Rum's trainer. So,
at what point did you then realise that you could make a living as a writer?
I think it was at college. Actually, I was doing English and law. And the chap that I was seeing at the time was doing a course in advertising. And I just didn't know such a thing existed. But him and the guy that he worked with or was at college with his partner, ostensibly. They were both art directors. So they would get these briefs and they didn't have anyone to write the headlines and stuff like that. So they'd be working on their college projects and I would write their headlines for them. And you know, just sort of put bits of body copy in there for them instead of lorem ipsum and stuff like that. And it was, that was kind of how I got into it, I think, really, in terms of realizing that copywriting was a thing that you could actually do and make money at. That I think that was the first time I really seriously thought, because I was going to be a lawyer. And then I was doing a foundation in law and I did a work placement in a legal office in Tunbridge Wells. And it was, I think, halfway through the second day when I was sitting there seriously contemplating gouging out my eyeballs with a biro that I thought, I can't do this. I literally can't do this. It was one of those fabulously silent offices with these two women where all you could hear was the ticking of the top of the clock. And then one of them, after sort of 35 minutes of silence, would come out and say, "We had pasties for tea last night." And then there would be another sort of 35 minutes of silence. And then the other one would go, "Oh, yeah." And I just thought, no, this isn't for me. So then I sort of got wind of the whole idea of copywriting and started doing some research and started doing some courses and writing to people. And that was it, really. It sort of sprung from there.
And so I do happen to know that you also had a sideline in writing Mills and Boone.
Yes.
Books.
Yes.
When did that happen?
I wasn't going to mention that.
Yeah, but I have.
I was in hospital and, you know, a long, long time ago, they used to bring the book trolley round and basically all it had on it was Mills and Boones. And I remember reading a couple and immediately clicking on to the fact that that it was just a formula, that actually the storyline in every single one was the same and it was just the names and the situation that changed. And
hang on a second. I've just realised that we're talking about this as if everyone will know exactly what Mills and Boone even
Mills
still
and Boone
exist?
Still exist, yeah. Only that, I mean, there's loads of different ones now. I mean, back in those days, it was just one particular, they were just like romance novels that were all quite sort of, you know, everything that happened. It was all very chaste. You know, there would any passion was sort of hinted at and then the bedroom door would be kicked shut and you were left to your own imagination. It was all passionate clinches in the orange groves and that sort of stuff. Throbbing manhood was about as raunchy as it got. But now they're all having sex by page 14 and I just can't. I can't write it.
You can't.
I don't know. I tried, actually. So I wrote this sex scene and I sent it to my mother.
Oh, good
and
choice.
Said, can you just read this and tell me if it's any good? And she phoned me up. She went, "Well, all I can say is the long winter evenings must just fly by in your house." Because that's the most turgid sex scene I've ever read in my life. So I thought, right, okay, obviously Mills. I was at a time when I was contemplating going back to writing Mills and Boone and then thought, no, perhaps I won't.
Well, back to, so you did write some.
I did.
You wrote some of the chaste.
I did write some of the chaste ones, yes. Again, just going back to what we were talking about, I realised there was a formula, basically, very quickly, because it's not exactly hidden. And I thought I could do this. And because I was bored, I just wrote one and sent it off for a laugh and it got accepted, they did, but it's a funny system, or it was back at, I don't know what it's like now. I mean, I'm talking well over 30 years ago, where you just got a flat fee. There was no royalties or anything like that, because they sold millions of them worldwide. I mean, I think they issued six a month or something at that time. Now they issue hundreds.
The day job was not Mills and Boone. The
no.
day job was copywriting.
Well, the day job then
or
was...
became copywriting.
It became copywriting, yeah.
Yes. So where Which agency did you start at? Was it an agency?
Wunderman. Wunderman World. Yeah, Wunderman Worldwide, actually. In a bid to get a foot in the door, I had started working there as... I worked in traffic. I basically kept badgering and they gave me a copy test.
Yes, a copy test,
yeah. And I had to write, I remember I had to write a letter because obviously it was good old DM, not above the line. And I had to write a letter for a fictional theme park, and it was for mothers in a local catchment area. I mean, very DM heavy. And I remember the first headline I ever wrote, and it was a day of discovery right on your doorstep. I was well in there with the alliteration, and then they started giving me little bits of copy to do, and I then got put in the hands of the head of copy there at the time. It was this amazing man called Tony Wallace, South African chap. And just one of the best writers ever I've ever worked with. And he taught me so much about everything from listening to an audience, you know, getting into the nuts and bolts of a brief, having a mental picture about who I was talking to, sorting out my messaging hierarchy. I mean, just so many different things. And just a brilliant writer. And I think I was so lucky to be at Wunderman at a time when there was people like him there who were prepared to just spend time with me and teach me, really. Teach me all the stuff that I just didn't really think about, you know, that wasn't innate. And I spent three years working for him. I mean, he's terrifying. He used to reduce people to tears. He was utterly, utterly terrified. But he also had a gun in his desk drawer.
A gun?
I like to think it wasn't loaded, but I was never entirely sure. And occasionally he just used to get it out and leave it lying on his desk.
Wow. Okay. Those were the days, eh?
I don't think it was real, but at least I hope not.
Bloody hell. We did have South African, you say?
Yeah.
Yeah, we had a South African traffic lady once who turned up with a riding crop. So much the same kind of idea.
And what did she do with this riding crop?
She used to sort of swish it through the air and it would make a loud sound. You think of it making contact with your body parts and you'd have to...
Did she charge for this?
not knowingly. Not that it, when I say not, I don't think so. But
interesting.
Let's draw a veil over that. Yeah. That sounds
moving
like
on.
Mills and Boone.
Yeah. All over again. Not the Mills and Boones I wrote. Good Lord, no. There was none of that business going on.
The modern ones, perhaps. A little bit of horse whipping. No, anyway.
digressing a little bit too far here.
Yes, I'll be doing the editing, obviously, later. Now, you say, of course, that this was DM, and you mentioned above and below the line. I'm not sure whether those terms are used very widely anymore. It all seems a bit kind of weirdly reductive. But in terms of what writers have to do now in an agency or anywhere, do you think the things that you learnt then are still applicable now? Because the media have changed, haven't they?
All digital is, and social and everything else, is a medium. It's a medium for conveying a message. And yes, it has different rules that apply in terms of how you put those messages together, how you literally construct them. But the content still has to be thought of. The idea still has to be there. The story still has to be in that medium. But unless there's actual content, readable content that people want to read and engage with, then it's nothing. It's an empty vessel. So I think I get really frustrated, actually, with this whole idea of the digital age being very different for creatives, because it isn't. I don't think it is anyway. I think it is just another avenue for us to reach out and meet people and, you know, and talk to people. And in some respects, it's a lot more personal, you know, which is great, because we can use all the data that's being gathered to tailor the message and to talk more directly to people. But ultimately, we're still communicating. We're just communicating through a different channel.
Yes, I mean, obviously there are differences from one medium to another in the way that they're consumed, or you know, people will read on their phone perhaps in a different way from how they read on the screen of a computer, and definitely from a piece of paper.
Yes,
but
yeah, I mean, there's definitely different, I think, art forms to how you write those messages. But fundamentally, at its core, there still has to be, you know, you still got to have something interesting to say to these people.
Well, one would hope so. I mean, that would be the starting point for me as well. I agree with you. It's got to be interesting. And I think the words are words, however they're...
Yes, however they're conveyed,
it's a completely banal comment, really. But no, I do remember an art director saying to me, in my own agency as well, so I thought it was particularly impertinent, but he said to me, the future is not going to be in the hands of copywriters anymore, because, you know, visual communication is replacing words. That's why I thought it was impertinent.
Oh, yeah.
And I said to him...
That's a sackable offence.
Well, I thought, can I just point out that we now actually read more than we've ever read before. So... when I started working, we didn't get emails every morning, certainly not hundreds of them. We didn't get that. We didn't have things to read there. We didn't get texts. There wasn't WhatsApp. There weren't websites. There was none of that. We didn't have any reading to do. But now you do get a whole bunch of emails and texts and what have you. They're all made up of words. So one would hope that, you know, everyone can write, can't they? Everyone can say something. But you and I would say, there is a skill here that you learnt, that you've described learning just now from this guy. Tony Wallace was his name? Did I get it right?
Yes. If he's still around, hi, Tony. I think you're still amazing.
Yes, and he clearly did a wonderful job, because, you know, there are things to be learnt about how to make effective communication. And the whole reason, in fact, why we're talking about this now is because people have said to me they would like in these podcasts for us to talk about copywriting, because I myself was and still am a copywriter, so I've got some thoughts on it. And that's one of the reasons we're having this conversation now, because there's a skill here that is transferable to any medium. You do have to think, of course, about the medium that you happen to be in. So writing...
Oh, God, yeah.
But that's always been true, hasn't it? So when we... Yeah. In our agency, we had clients who would use us not just for mail, but also for outdoor, as you mentioned, TV, obviously the new digital media. And if you're writing a headline for 48-sheet poster, which is still a medium that exists, it will not be the same thing as a headline on a press ad.
On a letter
or an email or anything else. There's a different... Yeah, so one should always be aware of the differences about how they're going to be perceived. My starting point in this, I came across a quote the other day by a musician, and he said, the primary task I feel is to create a piece of art that is better than the same amount of silence.
God, those are challenges.
I know. And I think, obviously, I'm not elevating what we do and saying that it's art, but it is true that nobody asked for what we have written and what we are writing. So we damn well better be better than the equivalent amount of silence, because that is the preferred option for most people when faced with a commercial message like the ones we have to write. So it's got to be better than that. And that needs, as you said, an idea. And I think you also mentioned telling a story. And storytelling, obviously, we've talked about that in a couple of other podcasts, because it's like flavor of the year or the decade, maybe. And rightly so, because telling a story and being able to draw someone in, that seems to me to be at the heart of what we're doing, whether it's in 140 characters or 280 or whatever it might be.
And I think that, you know, the medium is the challenge, isn't it? Like you said, telling a story in 140 characters is a lot harder than telling a story in a, you know, in a 30-second radio commercial, although that has challenges all of its own. I mean, you know, they all come with their different challenges. But I think some of the mediums we do have to work with now are tough, you know, tweets in particular. Yeah. But then you've got, who was it, Hemingway? Who
I knew you were going to say.
Who wrote,
do you remember it?
Baby shoes. Oh, for sale baby shoes never worn.
Correct.
So, you know, and there is a million stories right there in six words. So,
yes.
You know, and I think, but going back to what you said in terms of people preferring silence, I think it's a really interesting point because we're asking for people's time. You know, in anything we say, in anything we put out there, we're asking for people's time. And I think if they're generous enough to give it to us, we'd better be respectful of that and deliver something that makes that gift of time worthwhile on both sides. And I think that's always been the benchmark for me. I think it's always been the thing that I've measured my work by is if I was sitting on the other side of the fence, if I was receiving this, would I think it was time well spent?
I think that's a fantastic measure. Yes, go on.
Yeah, and if it's not, then I'll go back and I'll write it again and again and again until I think it's worthy.
That's a brilliant measure. So it's better than the equivalent amount of silence, and it is something that has used the time that they have been kind enough to give you, really.
Yes.
You know, it's given them something in return for their time.
Yeah. And I think, you know, if you do use that as a benchmark and you look at probably, 95, maybe even 99% of what's out there, it isn't worth the time that you give it. Or you don't give it because it's not, you don't give it any time because it isn't worth it. And I think, you know, I think a lot of people are forgetting that these days. I think certainly in my experience, a lot of clients, you know, I come across people who just say, we just want something. We've got this cheap media and we just want something to fill it, you know, and it's just like, well, that's rude. You know, that's treating your audience with disdain. It's like, you know, we just want something. No, fill it with something worthwhile if you're going to fill it with anything.
That is a really good point, isn't it? Because at least when we were in the days when there was a cost to production and a cost to communication, media costs, mailing or whatever it might be, the client was having to significant, you know, put a fair bit of money into the pot. Whereas now, obviously, they're paying, one hopes they're paying for the copywriting and art direction and what have you, but the cost of sending out a million emails is relatively trivial, isn't it? Compared to the cost of printing and mailing, for example, or, of course, making TV ads, which is hugely expensive. But, any, you know, what you're saying is because it's so cheap, it is given, in the client's mind, no value, and therefore anything will do. And what you're setting against that is you're asking for people to give you something that is incredibly valuable. So the price of it is not to be measured by the cost of the email. It's to be measured by the cost of the person's attention at the other end. I think that's a really excellent way to view it. And a difficult argument to win always. I mean, I've noticed because the client says,
I said it was my benchmark. I didn't say it was anybody else's.
Well, no, it's a great benchmark for you to have. And it's definitely made you an outstandingly good copywriter. There's no question about that.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, I take my hat off to you. Absolutely. We've worked together many times and you're always brilliant. But I feel the same thing that, you know, whenever I sit down to write anything, it has to be as good as I can possibly make it and better than anything I've done before, because like you, I know I'm prevailing on someone to give me their attention. So let it be worthwhile. Let me say something to them that will surprise them or delight them, as the Japanese like to say, or just evoke some kind of emotional response that will make them feel like...
Just engage them. Just engage them on, you know, really on any level, even if it's just for a couple of seconds to think, you know, then great. That's all I'll ask. I've always said to myself that in terms of writing copy, the day I say that'll do will be the day I'll stop. Because I think, you know, it always has to mean something. I have to look at something and say, yeah, I'm proud of that, or I'm pleased with that, you know, I'm happy with the way that turned out. And of course, you never are completely, because you'll go back to something a week later that you were happy with, and then you'll start editing it again. You know, it's kind of why I never really look at my past work, because you would always do something differently.
No, I know. I got into trouble in my second year or something as a copywriter, where a piece of work that had actually won an award came back and was going to be just slightly tweaked and then sent out again. And I got my hands on the copy file and started changing. I thought, no, this is, I know it won an award, but it could be better. But that's, yeah, but you know, yeah. I think I was right.
That's another place where I step out. I try and step outside myself in the way that, you know, I'll look at the, try and look at being the recipient and think, is this worth my time? It's again, it's stepping outside and saying, do I actually still understand what I'm saying here? You know, if you try and look at it from someone who hasn't read the brief, hasn't had all the background material, hasn't done loads of research on the competition and what everybody else is saying and thinking and doing, hasn't been thoroughly briefed on the product and is just coming to whatever it is you're talking about fresh, is trying to approach it from that angle and, you know, do I actually still understand what I'm talking about here? And if you don't, then you've overwritten
it. Yes, quite right. And we were talking in the podcast on briefing about the amount of information that you want. And I made a very clear case, I hope, for the creative brief to be very brief and one piece of paper. And then for there to be background information that the creatives and the writer in particular, in this instance, can use. But you're right. You've then got to be able to step away from that, because actually you can know too much. You've got to have an innocent eye in a way and be like the punter. And that's, you know, you don't want to know all about the kind of ins and outs of the marketing strategy and everything else. Not that we couldn't understand it or be fascinated by it on another day, but right now as the writer, no, that's not the punter's position, and you've got to be in their shoes.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah. I think that's the thing. If I was ever going to give people one piece of advice, it would to improve their writing. I mean, obviously, there's a million different things you can learn and do and read and listen to. But one of them is, you know, for me, the most important one would be step outside yourself and think, if I was receiving this, would I get it? Would I understand it? Would I know what you were trying to tell me? Like you said, look at it with an innocent eye.
I think that also connects to something we talked about recently, about going on the factory visit, as it were, and seeing how the thing is made or how people. Always good, right? And then you.
I love doing that. They don't do enough of that anymore. No. I used to work up north, and one of my clients was Seabrook's Crisps. It's a very northern brand, but you can still get it in some supermarkets down here. And I had. It was like the happiest day of my life. I had a tour of the crisp factory, and I saw the machines that make the crisp. But there was two brilliant machines. What the first one was when the crisps come out of the fryer and they get spread, and before they've even had any flavors put on them, they're literally just deep fried potato, still hot from the fryer. Oh my God, taste sensation. Best thing in the world. But then they go along this amazing machine. Sorry, this is absolutely nothing to do with copywriting, but there is a point. They go along this amazing machine, which is this conveyor belt with thousands of little holes underneath and cameras above. And these cameras look at the crisps, spot one that's got, you know, either is burnt or has a green little bit on it or an eye or whatever, some sort of defect, and it sends a message to the conveyor belt, and underneath all these holes is little blowers.
So they get puffed up in the air,
and it will send a puff of air, a really strong puff of air, which will blow the crisp off the conveyor belt and into this sort of pile of crisps on the pile of defunct crisps on the floor. And I just thought, my God, that was such an amazing machine. But the point I was making was that tour, I think, you know, it was a morning us having the tour, I think led to some of the nicest work that I have done in a long time, because there were things I learned about the crisp making process and the care and attention to detail that goes into it and the passion. I mean, some of the guys in this factory had worked there for 20 years and it was a family run business. And you know, people were passionate about their product and passionate about their flavors. And I got all of that through spending the day at the factory and talking to these people and seeing these machines and eating these crisps hot off the conveyor belt. And but stuff and insight and story that I wouldn't have got from a piece of paper. And a chat in a soulless room in an ad agency in London.
I agree with you. I think we're going to come back to this again in another podcast. I have a story myself about very early on. In fact, the same piece of work that I was referring to just now about rewriting it when it was sent out again, I have a story about how that piece came into being. And it was all about going out into the field. It was for the RSPCA and going out with an inspector and seeing them at work. And it wasn't what you'd think, because, you know, some of that can be quite harrowing, but it was actually a very funny day and lots of amusing things happened. But it gave me an insight that I could not have got from anywhere else. And you just can't. And then this is another thing about, it's not just the writers, but the creatives, as a, you know, anyone who's in the creative business, you have to be curious, you have to be absorbent, you have to be put in front of that stuff. And then it sits in the back of your brain until the moment comes when you sit down to come up with ideas. And then in our case, to write about it.
At the end of the day, we're all human. We're naturally curious creatures. And if something engages you, then the odds are it's going to engage your audience.
Oh. Well, yes, and nobody should be, I mean, the thing there is you can't know which part of that experience is going to then lead you to the piece of copy or the story that is going to be compelling. No. You have to go through all of it. And yeah, sure, it's probably not going to be about the crisp being blown up in the air, but it does say something about how much care they take. And then you learn more about that. So I think,
So a lot of it is interpretation as well. It's how you interpret that information that you get. But, you know, you have to have that information in the first place. And, you know, if it's all possible, as much of it as you can absorb. And then filter.
And then filter and then step. I mean, also, I think you have to have that passage of time so that when you come back to it, it's kind of incubated in your head. And then when you look at it, you're looking at it as you just wisely said, you've got to look at it as a consumer would, as a customer who doesn't know anything. And are you going to explain to them something about those crisps that they will think, as you put it, that's interesting. That tells me something about that brand. Ah, yeah. Yeah, I definitely need some crisps now.
I fancy, I really want some crisps, but in particular, I want Seabrook's crisps.
Yes, exactly, because they're made with...
Yeah, you know, because I can sell crisps, but I have to sell Seabrook's crisps. And it's funny because I think that time for things to percolate is what we're losing now in the digital age, because everything now moves so quickly and things, you know, it's like sort of disposable fashion. You know, we have disposable advertising. The turnover is so quick.
Yeah,
you know, it's
no, I know what you mean. People are going to say, well, it's always disposable, isn't it? Because you know, it's only a transient thing. But
I think the speed of turnover has increased massively, and again, because, as you pointed out earlier, the kind of budgets that clients used to have to commit to producing this stuff, then, you know, saying, well, we want to take a day out to go to the factory, really didn't make any odds. You know, it was, well, you know, it's going to take you 2 weeks to do this job if you spend one of those days in a factory, but great. But now it's like, well, you know, you've got 2 hours. You've got 2 hours to turn this around, because the coders or whoever it is, you know, want this stuff in order to hit tomorrow's deadline. It's also fast now.
It is fast, and also agencies have really they've actually made things worse for themselves by having an hours-based charging method for creative work. That's very common now. Terrible idea.
The timesheet. Oh.
Yes, I know. And it's just like, God. There's so much wrong with that, because it doesn't allow for the time to actually do the things we've just been talking about doesn't really allow for enough time for thinking. Everything's got to be done quickly. But the fact is that the value of something is not related to the amount of time that went into making it. And so therefore to charge that way is just wrong. And if people kind of scratch their heads at that thought, you can always ask them, how much did you pay for your house? And how long did it take for your house to be built?
Yeah.
Because no one would know the answer to that question.
Because it's irrelevant. Well, we went on talking about time-based charging. We talked about becoming an executive creative director, managing a large department, ageism, sexism, a lot of topics that deserve a lot more time. And rather than cramming them all into this podcast, I'd rather stay with the focus here on writing. So then, after a little while, we got back to the topic of the actual practicalities. Now, the next section is going to appeal particularly to writers because it's quite geeky and about equipment. And for those of you who are not writers and don't want to be, this might give you an insight into the lunacy that goes on inside a copywriter's mind, and you might find it entertaining. And for those of you that are writers, I'm sure you'll have stories to tell of your own.
I still write my first draft by hand.
Do you? Always?
Always have. Always.
And that includes the novels?
No. Although I do the outlines by hand. And you know, like basically novels and things consist, with me at least, consist on massive sticky notes stuck on a wall and get moved around. You know, you can't do that on a laptop. But to me, there is something visceral about writing, about actual handwriting, that engages me in the process in a way that writing something on a laptop can't do. So I think it's that, you know, I appreciate a laptop as a tool for editing once I've got a shape of what it is I want to do. But I can't write on a first draft of a laptop. I've tried. I stare at that blank screen and just nothing comes. I have to have a pen in my hand.
Well, and I know you're very picky about the pens.
For the ideas to come.
I've been in a stationery shop with you choosing pens.
Yeah.
I know.
I'm very picky about the pens and I'm very picky about the pencils.
Yeah.
They have to be Blackwing.
Oh, yeah, they're good. They are good.
Yeah. They have to be Blackwing. And I buy specific, in fact, I'm showing you one here now. I buy specific orange rubbers that go on the
end
as
That's interesting because I've got a Blackwing here, but I've got the black rubber. Orange rubber. Okay.
I get the orange.
Okay.
There's something about the contrast. But I have to write in a black biro, medium nib.
Yeah. A Bic, are we talking about? Bic biro?
Generally, I prefer a Bic, yes.
They're good, aren't they?
Bic crystal,
classic.
If at all possible.
I think
the classic pen.
Martin Amis once said, nothing can compare to the joy of uncapping a fresh Bic biro.
A fresh Bic. No, yeah, I'm right there with him. I buy them in boxes.
Yes, they are the best.
And a freshly sharpened Blackwing pencil.
We're getting into the realms of complete obsession here. But yes.
But they are little things, I think. They're little talisman. They're, you know, because we are quite a superstitious bunch, creatives and copywriters. And, you know, in the way that jockeys have a favourite shirt, you know, if you've got a notebook, like I always use Moleskine, and I use a particular type of pen because I've had success using that formula.
I'm with you 100%.
Therefore, why would I change it?
No, I've got a kind of pen that I will, for concepts, you know, scamps, if such things are still in existence. There's only one.
Oh, yeah, that's always an M50 bullet marker, isn't it?
Well, mine is a Pentel, the Pentel one, because I started with that and I had some early success and it's like, no, that's got to be it now. Just them, always have every time. But yes, of course, these rituals really count. So it's true for sports people as well. You're right about jockeys. Somebody told me the other day about a cricketer cricketers play, because the team that's batting, a lot of them are sitting in the pavilion kind of footling around. And this guy went out and made a big score. And when he came back in, it's the first time he'd scored a century. Someone had glued his one of his spare bats to the roof of the changing room because, you know, why not? They'd got time on their hands. But then he, forevermore, he had to have a bat glued to the roof of the changing room before he went out to bat because that would be the thing that made all the difference.
Yeah, I could completely understand that.
Yeah, absolutely. So being a great copywriter is all about learning from someone who knows what they're talking about, as you did, trying very hard, giving it time, really working at getting better and constantly driving yourself to do better, having the right pen and pencil and paper and some other rituals that really count.
These are incredibly important.
Massively. Things. And going to crisp factories whenever you can. Right? That's it.
Yeah.
I think we've covered all the bases. Yeah. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
It's been an absolute joy and highly educational for everyone concerned, I'm sure. Right. Okay, so thank you very much. And I look forward to seeing you for real before too long when we're all allowed out again.
And you.
Okay.
It's been fun. Thank you.
Yes.
That was another episode in our series of podcasts, 168 Things. I do hope you enjoyed it. We're always open for communication. If you want to get in touch, please email us on 168things@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. See you again soon. Bye.